Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria-Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Die Covid-19-Pandemie ist nicht vorbei. Dieser Schluss drängt sich nach den schlimmen Infektionszahlen in verschiedenen Teilen der Welt und nach neuen Ausbrüchen in Europa auf. Die unterschiedlichen Erfahrungen, die mit der ersten Welle der Infektion gemacht wurden, sind noch lange nicht verarbeitet. In Europa ist Schweden einen Sonderweg gegangen. Es gab keinen Lockdown wie in den skandinavischen Nachbarstaaten oder in Österreich. Für Kritiker der strengen Maßnahmen in Österreich und Deutschland erschien das skandinavische Land, das mit weniger Verboten ausgekommen ist, ein Vorbild. Aber in Schweden gab es viel mehr Opfer als in den strengen Nachbarstaaten. Eine äußerst kritische Bilanz des schwedischen Weges zieht der Politikwissenschaftler Joakim Palme. Joakim Palme unterrichtet an der Universität Uppsala. Er ist einer der führenden Sozialwissenschaftler des Landes. Das Kreisky-Forum lud Joakim Palme zum Online-Talk über seine Einschätzung. Der Sozialwissenschaftler ist der österreichischen Institution seit langem freundschaftlich verbunden. Sein Vater war Olaf Palme, der 1986 ermordete schwedische Regierungschef und ein persönlicher Freund Bruno Kreiskys. Das Gespräch mit Joakim Palme über den schwedischen Weg in der Corona-Krise führte Robert Miesig auf Englisch. Seine erste Frage lautete, was denn eigentlich genau unter diesem Begriff schwedischer Weg in der Corona-Krise zu verstehen ist.
Well, unfortunately, there is no very simple answer to that that question. So, if you allow me to just mention that there are in fact many both particularities and also similarities. I think what has been different is that Sweden has not gone for a lockdown strategy. So we have kept schools, both primary schools, kindergartens and secondary school, partly open. For the younger, fully open. We have not implemented very strict legal regulation on how people move about in society. But I should emphasize that also Sweden has imposed restrictions on how many people that can gather on one occasion, and the limit is 50. And that, of course, is important also restriction in a democratic society, and sort of is restricting the, I mean, fundamental democratic right to assemble publicly. So I think that also here there are some similarities with what other countries have done, but not as strict as in many, and not as strict as in Austria. I think when it comes to the decision making, there are also some particularities in the sense that the role of the public health agency has been very important, and I think this is really not a surprise because Sweden has the state structure is built on very small ministries and then independent public agencies with, of course, instructions from the government and and they're ruled by law, but they have a greater independence than what you see in many other European countries, maybe with the exception of Finland. And then I think there's also a kind of legal philosophical difference in Sweden, in the sense that our most recent legislation on communicable diseases is built on individual responsibility. So it's built on that individuals take the responsibility and are not sort of only threatened by sort of state punishment if they don't follow. So it's and I think that is also linked to the way that steering the public sector is done increasingly. It's not exclusively something that is about public health, but you can see the same kind of trust-based steering in other areas. So I think that there are some issues here, which is about public steering as well. And then I think there's been a lot of discussion of, you know, is there a particular Swedish sort of strategy also when it comes to goals of what both the public health agency and the government is trying to do, and here I think there's some confusion, but I think it's from my perspective it's clear that it's been about public health, but public health not only in terms of COVID but in a broader perspective. So it's been about contemplating collateral damages that can come out from very strict strategies, and that it has not really been about herd immunity, which I think has been one way of interpreting the strategy. And it's not been about the economy either. So it's been sort of from the public health agency, it's been clear. And the government has, by and large, followed the recommendation from the public health agency. And you know, on the political level, there has not been, I mean, at least not in the early stages, a questioning of the strategy that the government has been pursuing. Then there's been increased discussion, more heated also political discussion, but I think it's important that early on that there appeared to be a broad political agreement on the strategy.
Does this mean that at the beginning, at least, it was not discussed in the political sphere because it was a technocratic, pragmatic public service decided strategy, which is not part of the political controversy?
Well, I think that, I think that's a fairly correct description. Even if there was some sort of uncertainty, of course, part because we knew so little about the disease and the pandemic. But then there were sort of the government invited all political parties to discuss and so on. So there was a political forum created by the government. So I think that there was a political decision to follow. So it's not that they had to follow the instructions from the public health agency, but there was a conscious political decision to do that.
If you have now to judge the last, let's say, 3 months, now we have in Sweden, I looked for the figures today, 70,000 cases of COVID-19 and a fatality of 5,300. This is a high figure, a lot of casualties. On the one hand, on the other hand, you talked about about collateral damages that maybe didn't occur. If you try to balance that now, given also the situation that in May Sweden had the highest per capita casualties of the world, do you think it was a failure, or is not so sure if this it was a mistake, a failure, this this strategy?
I think it's been a failure clearly in terms of casualties. And clear failure in protecting the old, those who are really vulnerable to the disease in terms of losing their lives. I think the story is of course much more complicated than that. I would say that, I mean, you said that Sweden has the highest per capita. I don't think that's actually true, but we have Sweden, Belgium, and a few other countries are have very high figures. So the question is, could there have been other decisions made along the way which would have put Sweden on a sort of safer path? And without creating collateral damages and so on, but even contemplating on the potential of actually containing the spread of the disease, I think that is to me still an open question. I think that when we compare Sweden with Austria, with our Nordic neighbors, it's clear that. The lockdown, not least in Austria, but also in the other Nordic countries, was successful. I don't know if it was entirely, informed decision or if it was a bit of luck, but it was taken at the point when there was very little spread of the disease. And we see that in Sweden, we had a bigger spread of the disease from multiple sources at a very early phase of the pandemic. And when we look at the spread of the disease in Sweden, it's also clear that there's a huge local variation, as we see in Italy. If Sweden would have locked down, at the same time as Austria and the Nordic countries, we don't know if it would have worked. We could have very well ended up in the Belgian situation with mortality rates on par with what we got, and with the collateral damages coming from locking down society and locking schools, preschools, etc. Then there's also, another issue around the long-term development, and because the disease is still there. I think this is, I think, was guiding the Swedish decision makers, that they wanted to impose sustainable measures that could be sustained over a long period of time, calculating that it would take at least 1 year, possibly more, to come up with a reasonably effective vaccine, so that we would have to live with measures of trying to contain the disease and control the disease for a year. So I think this is something, the kinds of calculations that you have to engage in. So the brief answer is it's been a failure. The more difficult question is, could things have been done differently? And I think this has to be asked with a historical perspective. If we would have known exactly what we know today, I think it would have been much easier to do the right things. But given the information that we had earlier on this year, could we have or should we have made other decisions? And I think that's a very important thing to really
Because also we have to, at the end, we have to can discuss it in 1 year. Because also if you look at the figures, Sweden has 8 million people living in Sweden. It's just around the same like in Austria, and we have now 700 casualties, and you had 5,000 casualties. That's a lot of more. That's clear. Yes. On the other hand, it's not a totally catastrophe like we saw in Italy and the Swedish healthcare system and medical system and the emergency and in the intensive care systems. It worked. It was not in a shape like Italy. And on the other hand, we also now have to open up and stop the lockdown. And we see now already that it's a little bit difficult that as we opened up and we went away from the lockdown, and now we have new clusters, and we have to deal with it in the next month. So the question would be also, can Sweden be not a model for the first 3 months, but can we learn something from Sweden to deal with the pandemia on a more sustainable way in the next month?
I mean, I think that, the advantage that you have that made a reasonably successful lockdown in terms of reducing the number of casualties from COVID-19 is that you can use the experience and the increasing knowledge about the disease, because there have been a number of surprises and continues to be surprises about the nature of this virus and how it spread. And I think that, in Sweden has been an increasingly intense political discussion about this. It's been a very intense discussion among different scientists public figures and so on. Very strong emotional connotations around this. But there's some issues that they agree on, and that this is that the social distancing is very effective, and that basic hygiene is a fantastic tool to reduce the spread of the virus, and that you can achieve a lot with voluntary measures, and that you can also maintain basic functions in society, such as schools, hospitals, without a massive spread of the virus, if you follow a few basic principles. So I think, and this can be done on a voluntary basis. We can see that, the spread of other diseases, communicable diseases, such as stomach flu or the seasonal flu, went down drastically when the voluntary sort of distancing started and the sort of adaptation in terms of homework for those who could, etc. So I think that even if there's a lot of discussion in Sweden, there's some things that we have learned, and I think that can be of good use when you want to move from this lockdown into a more open. And also I think the what you mentioned, that you've been having these outbursts. We also have had some outbursts in regions that have been very little affected previously. And this also shows that this is a disease that spreads in cluster rather than evenly in society. So I think that, we have paid a high price, especially the oldest population. I hope that we can learn from that to reduce the casualties in the future, and that others can learn from that too, in terms of finding sustainable strategies of dealing with this.
Only for our audiences, how many people died in the elderly care systems just 60% of all deaths are in the elderly care system, so 70 years or something like that. Am I right?
Yeah, something like that. But it's also, we should recognize that the elderly care system is for very sick people. So that my guess is that many of those will be in hospitals in Austria. So it's really old people who are very, very sick and with a very low life expectancy to start with. So I think that this should be recognized as well when we are, because all these country comparisons are made difficult by the fact that we are comparing elderly care systems that have a very different character. Yeah, but I mean you also put I mean your finger on what was successful, and maybe too much emphasis was paid to the intensity care. So we saw what's happening in Italy, tried to learn from that, and sort of very important goal of the public health agency and for policymakers as well was to not hit the ceiling of the intensity care system, and that was successful. So there was spare capacity all the way. Peaking, I mean, the situation was most difficult in April, and then it's been coming down slowly. Now it's continuing to slow. The number of intensity care persons are 150 now in the entire country, and casualties are also down to very low figures.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So the discussion in actually everywhere in the world was totally emotional and also politicized, and the emotion, yes. The emotionality is maybe easy to understand because the people had fears and they didn't know, and we were facing a problem we could not judge. So this might be a main reason for that. But in many countries, it was primarily the left or the liberal left that was pro lockdown and shutdown, and the conservative right, or especially the far right, was for freedom and we should not overestimate a flu or something like that. The debate, like we have it in the US, mm-hmm. like we had it in Great Britain, like we had it also in Germany. In Austria, it was a little bit difficult because of Sebastian Kurz being chancellor. He's not really on the left. He's on the other side. But generally, it was the far right who is against the shutdown, and the center and the liberal and the left in favor of a shutdown. So obviously in Sweden, the debate, as far there is a debate, is the other way around, isn't it?
I think it's very it's a very confusing debate in the sense that I mean, we've seen that the far right in the US are against the state. They're sort of celebrating the Swedish strategy because it's less sort of intrusive in people's lives and so on. Here, I would say that some of the sort of strongest liberal voices in the political sphere, the chief editor of the biggest Swedish newspaper early on was very strongly arguing for lockdown. We see that there's some also active politicians from the Liberal parties. Some of them have been very strongly arguing for lockdown. So it's I think the Swedish strategy has sort of slightly different political and sort of history, genealogy, if you want to speak in those terms. I think that it's been guided a lot by sort of epidemiologists, and that there has been a lot of agreement, not only among the Swedish leading epidemiologists, but also they've been sort of referring to their colleagues internationally, and I think the Swedish state epidemiologist has been sort of talking about how shocked he was when the what he saw as the politicized lockdowns took place, not only in Eastern Europe, but also in the neighboring countries, and to some extent, I mean, the lockdowns also in our neighboring countries were made against the advice of their epidemiologists. So, I think that there's not a clear sort of liberal notion about this, and when you see the, I think the medical profession has been very influential here, but also in the medical professions there are different schools of thoughts. So some of those who are sort of active in infectious disease research, virologists, have been strongly advocating lockdown. So there's been a very heated and emotional debate also in the medical profession. And from my perspective, I think that is deeply problematic that they have not been able to stay away from their own emotions in terms of trying to create a science-based, scientific ground for policy advice and policy making. So I think the way that this disease has been politicized in not only in the political sphere, but also in the medical sphere is deeply problematic. So we need actually, I think, to lower the emotional level and really to start to engage in a systematic analysis and evaluation. Very difficult job, but I think it's very important, not only for the, I mean, continued combat of this disease, because there will be another virus, another pandemic, not next year, but in 5 or 10 years, and we need to prepare for that.
You talked at the beginning about the specifics of the political culture in Sweden that were also very important for the different paths Sweden made. You talked about the trust of the people, and you talked about the value that people decide for themselves and not only commanded, and also this very important element of the Swedish political culture, of the culture of consensus. After three months, were maybe a lot of people think it was a failure. Is this still intact, or is there maybe a problem of the Swedish civil consensus now, or is this still intact?
Well, I would like to question your interpretation of the Swedish political culture as consensus. I would say that there's been a lot of controversy in Swedish politics. The left-right divide has been very strong, very polarized. Also, I mean, we have a very organized labor market, which is, I mean, organizing, I mean, very different interests, capitalists and laborers, and then, but we have a culture of negotiation and compromise. But these are temporary truces rather than, you know, you just agree on everything. And I think that consensus is problematic in terms of adapting to new situations, because if you agree on everything when you enter something that is unknown, like the COVID virus, then you're not able to take in new information and use that to change your policies. So I think that, but then in order to be fruitful, in order to bring new insights, then you have to be much more sort of dialectical in the way that you discuss. You may have a idea, then you have a contrary idea, but then you need to have instruments to judge who is right and wrong. And for this, you need to have a better kind of climate. And here I think that there's another sort of partly forgotten but important Swedish culture, which is about the use of science for policymaking. So Sweden has been seen as the most modern society by many, and it's a modern society that has used economic science, social science, and medical science to reform institutions. And that also have a tradition of having public investigations that are used for systematic, working out a kind of basis, scientific basis for policymaking.
That because you corrected me and you did it right, that it's not consensus is part of the Swedish political culture as it was maybe some decades before, but is rationality an important element of the Swedish political culture?
Yeah, and I hope that this can be part restored, because I think it's now challenged by a very emotional discussion. And I think this is, I've talked with friends and colleagues, from my perspective, what you see in the media discussion is that those who criticize the public health agency are the most emotional. But those who are criticizing the public agencies this time also feel very attacked by what they see as the scientific establishment, so that they don't see that there is a rational possibility to engage in a critique of the strategies that have been pursued. So I think that there is definitely room for improvement to improve on policies and to prepare for next pandemic.
Sie hörten den schwedischen Politikwissenschaftler Joakim Palme in einem Online-Gespräch des Bruno-Kreisky-Forums mit Robert Miesig. Beim Bruno-Kreisky-Forum bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Diskussionen über die politischen Folgen der Corona-Krise inklusive internationaler Vergleiche gibt es jede Woche im Falter. Daher meine Empfehlung, abonnieren Sie den Falter, dann bleiben Sie auf dem Laufenden. Ein Falter-Abo kann man im Internet bestellen über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Anna Goldenberg betreut die Technik. Ich verabschiede mich, bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.